Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Maybe you found yourself in an actual debate, not a formal debate with an audience and podiums and things like that, but in a real debate, you're sitting there talking with someone, and before you know it, the subject of abortion or the issue of life comes up, and, well, before you know it, you're actually debating this person. And if you're like me, you might find yourself feeling a bit unprepared to engage in a debate, not just a conversation back and forth, what do you think about this, kind of pooling your opinions, but actually where people on either side hold opinions, pro and con, on the issue of abortion. How do you see through bogus arguments for abortion? How do you avoid bogus arguments against abortion so that your arguments are solid and hold water and don't fall through a couple minutes into the conversation? We're going to talk about defending the pro-life position during this hour of Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Sunday evening. It's August the 3rd. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment for our guest, Scott Klusendorf, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. You can also post your question or your comment on our Issues Etc. forum. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find the Issues Etc. forum. Post a question or comment right there. We'll find it, and we'll incorporate it into our conversation this evening with Scott Klusendorf. He's Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Good to be back with you.
Good to have you back. Let's get right to the heart of the matter, and if we're in that conversation that turns debate, where we are on the con position when it comes to abortion, and the other person is on the pro position when it comes to abortion, what should the focus of that conversation, that dialogue, that debate be if it's actually going to go anyplace?
Well, I would start off by announcing to people that you are pro-choice. In other words, you are every bit in favor of women choosing their own doctors, choosing their own health care, choosing their own boyfriends, choosing their own husbands, choosing their own religion, choosing their own God, choosing what church they want to attend. All those things are choices you 100% support for the women of this country. However, there are some choices that are wrong, like killing defenseless human beings simply because they're in the way and can't defend themselves. That's a choice we shouldn't allow. Now, notice what that tactic does immediately, Todd. What will then be the issue of the conversation?
Well, it will be the human beings, I assume.
That's right, because I've agreed with them that choice is a good thing. I think that too often we are fighting uphill because we are not willing to concede what is a good thing. And choice is good, but not all choices are good. So by framing the debate that way, by saying you are in favor of some choices, and in fact, you're in favor of people having a whole lot of choices. In fact, we could argue that most pro-life advocates are far more pro-choice than most of those on the political left, because we're not the ones that want to take away the choice of parents to decide where their kids go to school. We're not the ones that want to take the choice away from landowners who want to build things on their property but can't because there's a snail darter that might have lived there sometime in the last 100 years. We are very pro-choice, but there is one choice that we think is immoral, and that is taking the life of a defenseless human being without justification. Now, notice what I have not done yet. I haven't even discussed abortion yet. In fact, I haven't even brought the word into the conversation. The only thing I've done is frame the issue, which is, what is the unborn? And that will then become the focus of the discussion, and that's where the topic ought to start.
Well, you know the old saying that he who frames the argument generally wins.
Yeah.
Now, since the focus of this debate slash conversation on the life issue ought to be the defenseless human being at question, whose life may or may not be taken, depending on what position one takes in the debate, how does one then initially, at least in a general way, avoid false frames for this argument, or false frames for the debate?
Yeah, I think one of the things you do after you attempt to frame the debate around the question of what is the unborn is to very graciously ask the question, does it matter what evidence I'm going to present in this conversation? In other words, don't say it sarcastically. It's not like a husband and wife quarreling where one of them says, well, does what I say even matter? I mean, that's not what we mean here. But you very graciously say, look, you know, we can save each other a lot of time here if we don't want to even discuss this at an evidential level. And with that in mind, do the facts that I'm going to bring out have any chance at all at weighing in on your decision-making here? And if the answer is no, then I think you've exposed from the outset that this person really doesn't want to have a debate. What they want to do is simply have perhaps a shouting match, or maybe they just want to toss out a bunch of cliches, but there's not going to be any real exchange of ideas. So I think that most of the time when people hear that question, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say, well, of course the facts matter, and of course if you can show evidence, I'll reconsider my view, because who wants to be painted as so close-minded that you won't reconsider your view? I don't know about you, Todd, but if somebody presented compelling evidence to show that the unborn were not human, wouldn't you reconsider your view? I would.
If it could be shown.
Exactly. Now exactly. So I am willing to concede that I will reconsider my view if, in fact, there is evidence that refutes what I'm going to present. So that kind of sets up the whole exchange. In other words, we're going to discuss one issue, what is the unborn, and we're going to focus on the evidence rather than on the worn-out, tired-out sound bites that people toss around on both sides of the issue. So that's kind of how I like to start things.
Someone is out there listening. They are a devout Christian. They go to church. They're a Bible-believing Christian. They say, look, I've looked in my Bible.
Yeah.
Abortion isn't in there. So why isn't abortion just a matter of Christian freedom?
Well, that is a great question. And my first reply is that the Bible does not directly discuss a lot of issues like drive-by shootings, lynching homosexuals for fun, killing abortion doctors. I mean, those are things that are not specifically prohibited in Scripture, and yet we know they are wrong by inference. And here's what I mean by that. Just because the Bible doesn't condemn something doesn't mean it condones it. We know, for example, that racial genocide is wrong, not because every single race is mentioned in Scripture. It's not. By the way, find me a chapter and verse that says that the French are human. There's a lot of people today that would dispute that question, but especially after 9/11. But the fact of the matter is, we know that the French, the Germans, the Japanese, those who live in Thailand, it doesn't matter what your nationality, if you are a human being, the Scripture is very clear that God desires to have fellowship with all of humanity because humanity is made in His image. And therefore, we don't need to ask, well, where does the Bible show that the Chinese are human? It doesn't. We don't need that. All we need to know is, are the Chinese human? And if they are, then the Scriptures that make it clear God desires to have fellowship with His created beings apply to the Chinese as they do those of us who are Caucasian, those of us who are Canadian, American, French, English, it does not matter. So when people say to me that the Bible is silent on abortion, my first question to them is, are you saying that whenever the Bible doesn't condemn something, it condones it? Well, they're going to say no, and then my next point will be, well, then what is it that you're getting at? Because there's this hidden premise there that says that if the Bible doesn't specifically condemn it, I can do it. Well, that's simply not the case. And I think, Todd, that what we need to do with Scripture is go ahead and concede, not that we can't make a good case doing it the other way, but let's go ahead and concede that nowhere does the Bible condemn abortion and nowhere does the Bible teach that the unborn are human. Let's go ahead and concede that. If I can show, using science and philosophy, that the unborn are human, then I don't need the Bible to specifically tell me they're human or the Bible to specifically tell me that abortion is wrong. I can know it by moral inference, and that's the point here.
We've only got a minute and a half here before we go to our first break. You say that one of the biggest mistakes made on both sides of this debate on the issue of abortion is confusing objective claims with subjective claims. With only a minute here before the break, explain what you're saying there.
Well, my colleague Greg Kokel has just done masterful work on this topic, but to borrow one of his explanations, if I say I like vanilla ice cream and I don't like chocolate, that is not an objective truth claim. It's a preference claim. If I say it's wrong to torture toddlers for fun, I'm not telling you what I prefer as a matter of taste. I'm making a claim about what I believe to be right and true. And the culture today often does not understand the difference between those two types of claims. And our job as Christians is to help them understand that there is objective truth claim. There are objective truth claims, and they can be known.
When we come back from this break, how do you respond when someone, and you're talking about abortion, it turns into a debate, someone says, look, that's just your view. It sounds a bit like a confusion of an objective truth claim with a subjective opinion. We'll find out how Scott responds when we come back from this break. Scott Klusendorf is our guest. We're talking about defending the pro-life position. He's director of bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. You can join this conversation, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We'll also be talking a little later about other mistakes we make in the debate over abortion. 1-800-730-2727, or post a question or a comment on our Issues Etc. forum at issuesetc.org. You'll find it there. Post your questions or comments. We'll include them in our conversation with Scott Klusendorf.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology. The latest issue also contains articles titled, The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart by Pastor Eric Rotman, Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay, From Evangelicalism to the Evangel. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Next week on Issues Etc., we'll discuss a lawyer's quest for the gospel. Craig Parton, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August, will be our guest. The book is called The Defense Never Rests. Is there a severe famine of the gospel in many evangelical churches? Has the cross of Jesus Christ been replaced by self-improvement or self-fulfillment? We'll talk about it next week on Issues Etc. with Craig Parton. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing for the rest of the summer and into the fall, check out our website, issuesetc.org. While you're there, be sure to read about Craig Parton's new book, The Defense Never Rests. This book approaches the basic question of what it means to be evangelical, truly evangelical, and whether or not a crossless Christianity can ever be truly evangelical. You can order the book, The Defense Never Rests, online, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, The Defense Never Rests, 1-800-325-3040. The book costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. We're talking about defending the pro-life position with Scott Klusendorf. Scott, how do you respond when someone proffers in the midst of this debate over abortion, that's just your view? I have my view, you have your view, and all you're saying is just your view.
I think I'd reply that it's just their view, that it's just my view. I mean, basically what they're saying is there are no truth claims you can legitimately make, but here's one. That's just your view that you just said to me. It's really a way to short-circuit an argument rather than defend one's own position. And there's an old saying in law school that if you're in the midst of a court case and you're losing the debate on the facts of the matter, the best thing you can do is make a lot of distraction by pounding the table loudly. And this is an example of someone pounding the table rather than actually refuting the argument. Look, when a pro-life advocate says elective abortion takes the life of a defenseless human being, that pro-lifer is not making a claim about what they like or prefer. In fact, let's assume for the sake of argument that an abortionist who kills fetuses 5 days a week but on weekends argues that the pro-life position is true, and he makes the statement, elective abortion takes the life of a defenseless human being. That statement can still be true even if his lifestyle is totally inconsistent with what he claims is real. And the point here is that truth claims, unlike claims about ice cream, stand or fall on the basis of the evidence. They don't stand or fall on the basis of my preferences or my tastes or my likes. So when someone says to me, well, you're opposed to abortion, that's just your view. Notice what they've done. They've taken my truth claim about what is real, and they've changed it into a preference claim that they like better. And they often think that it's easier for them to dismiss it that way, because after all, who's going to argue, Todd, that vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate? No one in their right mind is going to argue that that can be known as an objective fact. But if I say, as I said a moment ago, that it's wrong to torture toddlers for fun, or it's wrong to rape women for fun, these are not preference claims about what I might prefer. They are truths that I'm expressing that maybe are false, maybe they can be shown to be wrong, but they are not preference claims, they're truth claims.
Okay, here's a variation on that theme, and it also seems to be steeped in moral relativism, and we usually hear it in this form, don't force your morality on me.
Yeah, that's relativism. Again, it's the same kind of inconsistent reasoning. The person is saying, hey, there's no moral rules out there, but here's one. You shouldn't force your view on me. Well, what are they doing to you at that point? Well, obviously what they're doing is they're forcing their view on you. I mean, look, if there are no moral rules, who are they to demand that I be tolerant? I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever. The only way they can claim that I'm wrong, and notice the word I chose, the only way they can claim that I'm wrong and shouldn't force my view is if they assume that morals are real things, which is the very thing they're angry at me for doing.
Okay. This one's a little harder to sort out. I'm personally opposed to abortion. I find it abhorrent. I believe it to be murder. But I still believe it should be legal.
Yeah. And you know what, Todd? I'll tell you what. There are just, it grieves me, but there are literally thousands of Christian leaders that we encounter over the years that have that same kind of viewpoint, that, you know, hey, I'm going to personally oppose this, but I'm not going to take a stand morally on it. I don't think it ought to be made illegal. And when people tell me that they personally oppose abortion but think it ought to be legal, the first question I ask is, why are you personally opposed? And the question kind of throws them back on their heels. Well, what do you mean, why am I personally opposed? Well, why are you personally opposed? Well, because it kills a human being, a baby. And by the way, that's the only reasonable answer they can give, because if abortion is no different than having your tooth pulled, why be opposed to it at all? So the only answer they can give and maintain any kind of logical consistency is to say they oppose it because it takes the life of a human being. At which point, I come back and say, do you mind if I repeat back what you just said to me? You personally oppose abortion because it kills a defenseless human being, but you think it ought to be legal to kill defenseless human beings? Well, usually the reply, Todd, at that point is just stunned silence. People say, well, I've never thought of it that way. And that's if they're being intellectually honest. Perhaps more common is the reply, oh, no, that's not what I'm saying. Well, yeah, it is what you're saying. Because if there's no human being involved, there's no reason to oppose abortion whatsoever.
What about a similar statement? I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I don't think I should impose my values on someone else.
Well, even that statement imposes values. Because if your view is that you shouldn't impose your values, but you're telling me I shouldn't impose my values, what are you doing to me? You're imposing your values on me. And this is one of the things that my colleague Greg Kokel has done great work on the subject of relativism. In fact, he's even got a book that he co-authored with Frank Beckwith on that very topic called Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, which folks can get from our STR website. But that in that book, Greg talks about how relativism is self-refuting. In other words, the very people who claim that there is no morality that we ought to force on anyone else turn right around and force their own moral views on us. And that's a clear example of what's going on here. And by the way, every law on our books, Todd, imposes a moral view on someone. In fact, I could make a good case that any law that doesn't impose morality is a bad law. I love it when people say things like, well, we can't legislate morality. Oh, really? What on earth, pray tell, can we legislate then? I mean, should we legislate based on the personal preferences of lawmakers? What if lawmakers happen to prefer chocolate shakes over vanilla ones? Should we allow them to mandate that we will eat chocolate shakes rather than vanilla ones? I mean, the only legitimate basis for law is morality. That was a point that Aristotle made. That was a point that has been argued through the classical philosophers. Indeed, our entire legal system in Western culture is founded on the idea that morals are real and that the laws we make ought to reflect those morals. Now, it doesn't follow from that that we ought to make everything that's immoral illegal, but it does mean that the law needs to be founded on objective moral truth.
We're talking about defending the pro-life position with Scott Klusendorf, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. You can check out the website for Stand to Reason. Simply go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Scott Klusendorf and Stand to Reason. Or, if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. We'll give you the phone number and the mailing address for Stand to Reason, 1-800-737-0172. Why are the sermons and songs in many evangelical churches more about the Christian than the Christ? What does it mean to be truly evangelical? Can a crossless Christianity ever be truly evangelical? Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin, host of Issues Etc. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for August is called The Defense Never Rests by Craig Parton. You can order this powerful critique of American Christianity by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or order The Defense Never Rests online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Defense Never Rests. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with Pastor Paul McCain, Interim President and CEO of Concordia Publishing House, based here in St. Louis. Paul, what's the current state of publishing, and Christian publishing in particular?
Well, with the economy the way it is, all publishing has been impacted by the downturn. And as I read the trade journals, it's interesting to note that many publishers are trying to identify ways to keep their prices down, even as their costs are increasing. The publishing industry is completely consumer-driven. You just have to walk into any large megastore like Barnes & Noble's, Borders, those types of stores to notice that. The Christian publishing industry faces very unique challenges. It's a large industry. A number of the largest publishers are traded publicly traded companies like Thomas Nelson. They do millions and millions and millions of dollars a year in business. I just recently read an interesting article in Publishers Weekly, which is kind of the trade bible for the whole industry. And in the religion section, they point out that Christian publishers are most interested in meeting consumer demands for self-help books of all kinds. They say people would rather go to a bookstore than talk to their pastor, rabbi, or imam, and that's a big challenge.
So how is Concordia Publishing House different in the field of Christian publishing?
Concordia Publishing House exists to serve the publishing needs of our church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we believe that as we do, the best job we can possibly do in getting out materials that are faithful to the witness of the Lutheran Reformation, that we're not only serving our church, but also all Christians who find very appealing the message of Martin Luther, the great breakthrough of the gospel in the 16th century. The Lutheran Reformation is the oldest continuing evangelical movement in the history of the church, and it continues to this day, and we're very humbled by the opportunity we have at Concordia Publishing House to be what we believe to be the preeminent voice for the Lutheran Reformation in publishing in the English language. And all our materials strive to be faithful to God's Word and to our Lutheran confessions to get out clearly the gospel of Jesus Christ. We emphasize the teaching of the faith, how important it is to train people, to educate them, to inform them in the basics of Christianity. And all our materials, from Sunday school to academic books, strive to do that.
That's Pastor Paul McCain, Interim President and CEO of Concordia Publishing House, based here in St. Louis. If you'd like a free catalog from Concordia Publishing House, call them at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit them on the web at www.cph.org. www.cph.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about defending the pro-life position. Scott Klusendorf, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, is our guest. You can read several articles by our guest, Scott, on our website, issuesetc.org. Go to the What's New section there at the website, and you'll find these articles, including one titled, Five Bad Ways to Argue About Abortion, on our website, issuesetc.org. Scott, this is often heard, and this one sometimes has put me back on my heels. Those who oppose abortion are simply uptight white men. They're Bible-thumping, they're anti-woman, they're sexist. And I find myself trying to prove, after this has been laid out on the table, that I'm just a nice guy. And in the debate over the unborn kind of gets lost there. It becomes a debate of whether I'm a decent person.
Yeah. Well, this is another tactic. Again, when you don't have the facts on your side, the best thing you can do is change the subject. And we do this all the time. Look, it's called the ad hominem attack. It's where you start to attack the person rather than refute the evidence the person is presenting. You know, it's like if I'm having a discussion with my 13-year-old and he starts to win the argument and I shut him down by saying, oh, that's just irrelevant. By the way, your room is messy. Go clean it. Well, I've changed the topic. He may be winning on principle, but I've changed the topic. And I hope I don't do that, by the way, but it's a common thing we tend to do as humans, and people on the abortion debate love to do this. Well, you're just a man. What right do you have to talk on abortion? Well, you know, sometimes I'm tempted to just look at the person and say, well, how do you know that I'm a man? I mean, I know that sounds like I'm pushing the envelope, but it's true. What does that have to do with anything? What if I weren't a man? What if I were a cross-dresser dressed up as one? Would that change the nature of the argument I'm making? And by the way, many pro-life women use the exact same arguments I do. So the fact that I'm a man, and let's say I'm religious and I'm uptight and I'm intolerant, well, Christian pro-life women and even non-Christian pro-life women use the very same scientific and philosophic arguments I advance. And so therefore, you must refute my argument without attacking me personally.
All right. This is a little more subtle, and you're going to have to guide us a bit in spotting this one, if we could. And that is the circular reasoning that often takes place, or some it's technically called begging the question, that takes place when advocates of abortion on demand assume,
as a given what they're attempting to prove in their argument.
Yeah, and again, this is very common. If I say to you, for example, that a woman has a right to control her own body, and therefore abortion is permitted, well, I'm making a huge assumption in that argument, or in that assertion, really, is what it is, that I have not defended. In fact, I'm assuming the very thing I'm trying to prove, and let me explain what I mean. When I say a woman has a right to control her own body and therefore has a right to an abortion, I'm assuming there's only one body involved in the abortion decision, hers. But isn't the entire abortion debate about the question, is there one human being involved or two? So by simply assuming that there's only one, in other words, assuming the conclusion of my argument in the premise of my argument, I avoid having to defend what might be uncomfortable for me to have to defend. And that's called begging the question. Another way would be as if I said to you, the St. Louis Cardinals are the best team in baseball because no team is as good. Well, I haven't presented any evidence to show that the St. Louis Cardinals are the best team in baseball, although I will say I know they're better than the Los Angeles Dodgers. But the fact of the matter is, if I just say they're the best team because no team is as good, I've done nothing to present evidence to make my claim. I've simply assumed in the premise of my argument the conclusion I hope to arrive at. And since abortion advocates want to ultimately show that the unborn are not human, then what follows is they often assume that premise, or assume that conclusion when they're making their case.
This really seems to require that the pro-lifer who will encounter these arguments carefully listen just beyond the rhetoric.
Yeah.
And really say, is this a valid, just in the logical sense, is this a valid argument?
Yeah, I think we need to listen for two things. Number one, when someone is talking to us defending abortion, we need to ask ourselves, what does their statement assume about the status of the unborn? That's number one. And number two is, what does their argument assume about what makes humans valuable? And if you filter through those two assumptions, you can get what the real principle is they're advancing. Let me give you an example of this. Someone comes to me and says, well, if we don't have abortion rights, if we disallow abortion, there's going to be all these unwanted and abused children running around, and that's going to be a horrible drain on our social services, and it's going to be a terrible thing. Therefore, we need abortion to prevent unwanted children. I do have to add that that argument has always struck me as rather comical. I mean, abortion advocates are the only ones I know who suggest that the way to end child abuse is to kill the intended victim. But that aside, think of this. What are they assuming about the unborn? Well, aren't they assuming the unborn are not human? Yeah, they are. And you know how I know that? These same people would never argue that we ought to just round up all two-year-olds and execute them if they happen to be unwanted. They only suggest that we do that to fetuses, not to two-year-olds, which tells me they're making an assumption about the fetus that they don't make about the two-year-old. Do you see how that works? So that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is to ask, what makes human beings valuable? In terms of what this person has just said to me, what makes humans valuable? And if they say to me, for example, well, the unborn are not human because they're not self-conscious. Well, gee, newborns are not self-conscious. As a matter of principle, when you assert that human value is based on an acquired property like consciousness, you don't just rule out the unborn from having human value. You rule out the senile, the newborn, those who are temporarily comatose, and a whole host of other people. So those two assumptions, what are they assuming about the status of the unborn, and what are they assuming about what makes humans valuable, will really help you clarify these things.
One more quick one before we go to the phones. Someone, and this often stumps us in the conversation, pro-lifers in the conversation, and that is the appeal to the truly hard case.
Yeah.
To the truly difficult situation. Give us an example, and how do you respond?
Well, I think people are, it's human nature to be struck with the plight of a woman who's been sexually assaulted. You know, she's been raped, she has been injured, psychologically scarred, and then to pour even more salt in the wound, we find out she's pregnant. I mean, who among us wouldn't want to immediately do whatever would be necessary to alleviate as much as possible, relieve that woman's pain? So that's a very human thing. And so I understand why people almost have this intuition that abortion is permissible in that situation. But I think it's a naive intuition, and let me explain why. It really gets back to the central question we began with: what is the unborn? Would anybody suggest that it would be okay to kill a two-year-old whose father was a rapist if it would make the mother feel better? Well, of course, people right away say, no, you can't do that. And my question is, well, why not? Well, because that two-year-old's a human being. Ah, then if the child conceived through rape is human, then isn't it wrong to kill the unborn human because his father was a rapist, just like it would be wrong to kill the two-year-old because his father was a rapist? And they'll say, well, that's not the same thing. You're assuming the unborn are human like two-year-olds, and they're not human like two-year-olds. Ah, that's the issue. Are they the same? The real moral issue here is not rape. The real moral question is, how do we treat innocent human beings that remind us of a painful event? Is it okay to kill them so we can feel better? Now, I think it'd be a mistake, Todd, for pro-lifers to downplay the psychological pain a woman has if she gives birth to this child and raises it. Let's be real. Is she going to be reminded of that rape? Yeah, very possibly. Some women may be, you know, fine. They get on with it. Not all women suffer. But let's be real and admit that some would, and that when that mother looks at that child, she will have those memories. Let's agree with that. But then let's go a step further and ask, does hardship justify homicide? Is it okay for me to kill another defenseless human being simply because that will make me feel better? That's the moral issue.
Join our conversation. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Nathan calling from Oklahoma City, listening on KQCV. Nathan, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
Good. You've touched on a lot of the issues that I wanted to ask you about, but you were just right in the middle of one. What if it's not necessarily a woman who was raped, but a child who was raped and ended up pregnant?
Yeah, good question, Nathan. The same moral principle applies. Let's assume we've got a 12-year-old girl, 13-year-old girl. She has been raped. And is it a tragedy? Yes, I agree with you completely. Is it a true fact that she's been violated? Absolutely. The question then becomes, what ought we do given the facts? Given the fact she's been violated, given the fact she's now pregnant, what is the morally correct thing to do? Is it okay to take the life of another defenseless human being so that 13-year-old will feel better? That becomes the moral question. Now, I have to admit something, Nathan, and I'm a little different than some pro-life advocates here. I'm willing to admit that at a preference level, I don't like the answer I just gave you. I would much rather just say, hey, let's just do whatever's necessary. That's what I'm drawn to. But more moral principle applies here, and that moral principle is that I do not have the right to take the life of a defenseless human being, even if I've suffered a grave injustice, so that I can feel better. In other words, sometimes it's better to suffer evil rather than inflict it. And I can give you an example of this. During the recent war with Iraq, we heard stories of people that were being tortured by Saddam Hussein's regime, specifically his sons, who at times would do things like drop people into grinders and hang them up and burn them alive, all kinds of just horrific things.
We've got about 1 minute here, Scott.
Yeah, let's assume that we had a American soldier who was captured, and five of his men were captured with him. And let's say the Iraqis came to him and said, we will torture you because we need to get intelligence information, but if you help us torture your own men, we won't torture you. Now, would the leader of that unit of American soldiers be justified in torturing his own men simply so he could avoid being tortured? No, we'd say, no, that you can't do that. It would be better for him to suffer the evil rather than inflict it. And though it sounds like we're being harsh here, the reality is the same is true with a woman who's been sexually assaulted. Do we feel pity? Yes, but hardship does not justify homicide.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest. We're talking about defending the pro-life position. Our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727. If you're getting a busy signal, keep trying. We'll be freeing up some phones after this break.
Defending Life from Beginning to End. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration. If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to know how to contact Scott Klusendorf, our guest, and Stand to Reason, or if you'd like to help defend life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible donation to Issues Etc., call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or you can write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Steve is calling from Roanoke, Virginia, listening on XM Radio. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, good evening, gents. How you doing?
Very well.
Good, Steve.
I'll try to make it quick. I have two things I'd like you to address. When I was a younger man, I put a woman in a position where she felt she had no choice but to go to an abortion clinic. And I took the typical American attitude at the time of, oh, I'm pro-choice, you know, let her decide because that relieves me of responsibility. Later in my life, I lost a son who was born with a genetic defect in his spinal column. And until that happened, I didn't realize the value of the life I'd lost earlier and my own responsibility in the taking of that life. I am saved. Now I'm a Christian. I have different viewpoints. So the two things I'd like you to help me when I'm talking to pro-abortion advocates is focusing on the man's responsibilities and or rights. And the second issue would be the use of the DNA legal argument for establishing the humanity of the unborn child.
Two good points to raise.
Very
there,
good
Steve.
Questions. Thank you, Steve. And my heart goes out to you for the grief you've suffered on both of those accounts. First, on the DNA issue, there is value in arguing that the unborn are human based on DNA, but that alone is not sufficient. And let me explain why. Every cell in our body has DNA in it, has human DNA. If I take my hand, as I'm doing right now, and I pluck cells off it, I've plucked off several hundred cells, each of which contain my DNA code. In fact, you could conceivably take one of those cells and extract the DNA from it and, through a cloning process, create another human being by mixing it with a female egg or implanting it inside a vacated female egg and adding some chemicals and electricity, and voila, we've got a genetic copy of me. At least that's the theory. So what we want to do is not argue that the DNA is sufficient to establish that the unborn are human. What we want to do is show that the unborn, unlike other bodily cells or unlike sperm and ovum, are genetically distinct whole human beings. They're not part of a human being like the cells I'm picking off my hand right now. Rather, the unborn are themselves whole human beings. Sure, they're small. They have yet to develop. They have yet to grow, but they are full, whole human beings nonetheless. And that's not, by the way, just an opinion or a preference. That is actually a scientific fact. In other words, the facts of science make clear that from the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. That's a great sentence to memorize because it sums up the scientific knowledge. And it's true they have yet to grow, but they're whole human beings nonetheless. And so DNA is appropriate for maybe helping us identify what is a human being, but it's not enough to say that that alone
will do the trick. So our better move is to show that the unborn are whole human beings, and we know that in part because of their DNA, but we also know it in part because they are not merely part of another human, they're whole humans. Your second question about men, that's a very good question, and it comes up a lot. And I think there's a lot of men out there who have been involved in abortion-related decisions that are asking questions about, well, what does this mean for me? Hey, 20 years ago I did this, 10 years ago I did, I did that, 5 years ago I helped a girl who was pregnant by me get an abortion. There's a couple of things I would point out, and you've hit on the main one. Number one, you know that Christ forgives sin, and he will forgive that one as well. I'm not suggesting we take a flippant attitude toward abortion, not by any means, and we should never presume on God's grace by just going out and doing things we know to be wrong. But the fact of the matter is that when we look back on our lives and we see those regrettable decisions we made, there is a provision for that at the cross. And if the gospel is being preached the way it should be, we will know that because we will know that outside of Christ's righteousness, there's nothing that can sustain us in the presence of a holy God. So that grace applies to us, and we don't deserve it. We don't earn it. It's simply imputed to us. And that is a message that men need to hear. I do want to say one other thing about men. Men are often shut out of this debate because they think they have no moral right to speak on abortion because they're not men and they can't, or they're not women and they can't get pregnant. I long for the day, Steve, when we will see an army of men committed to Christian apologetics, meaning who stand up and intellectually defend the faith, and they become leaders in their churches who help train the youth of those churches to defend their views persuasively. And one of the areas we need to train our youth is on the issue of abortion, training them to defend the thesis that the unborn are valuable human beings and that abortion is an objective moral wrong. And that's something we've got to train our kids to do, and that's something that men like you can take a role in.
Let's take one more call before we round off our conversation. Scott, you got about 1 minute to respond to David. He's calling from Wheaton, Illinois, listening on WYLL. David, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, the rationale that you express is certainly something that I fully follow. At the same time, as I'm thinking in terms of the political reality, if some compromise were to get us further along politically, we may in fact save more lives ultimately by compromising and incrementally going towards a more pro-life position.
All right,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Short on time, let me answer that quickly. I am an incrementalist, and I will support any piece of legislation that works to end abortion, even if it's not a perfect ban on abortion. So I'm with you on that. You and I have no dispute on that at all.
All right. One last question very briefly. With only 1 minute, what does the prepared pro-lifer need to be certain of on those two points you mentioned before that have played through our conversation? Number one, the status of the unborn. Number two, the intrinsic value of a human being.
Well, those are the two points we need to be certain of, and we need to know secular arguments for making those claims. We need to know scientifically that the unborn come to be at conception, and that at conception you have a genetically distinct whole living human organism. You don't have part of a human body that is attached to something else. You have a whole living human organism. And then secondly, we need to be able to show that anytime you advance an argument that human beings only have value because of an acquired property, like, say, consciousness or self-awareness, as soon as you do that, you not only disqualify the unborn, you disqualify other groups, such as newborns, who we now know are not self-aware until about 9 months after birth. Does it follow then that infanticide should be permitted? Hey, that's what Peter Singer argues, and you know what? He's right about that point. If self-consciousness makes us valuable, which is the prevailing view in the secular culture, you can't draw an artificial line at birth that spares the newborn while you kill the fetus. You got to kill both. And Singer, at least, is consistent on that point.
Folks, we'll be continuing to take your phone calls and emails for Scott Klusendorf on defending the pro-life position in the next hour. We'll be giving away copies of Scott's booklet called Pro-Life 101 to the very best callers in the next hour at 1-800-730-2000. 1-800-273-2727. We'll let you stay on the line to hear the response to your question or your comment. 1-800-730-2727. Or you can post a question or comment on our Issues Etc. forum, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find the Issues Etc. forum, issuesetc.org. You can tune in live in the next hour on the internet. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the worldwide KFUO logo, and listen there. Call during this break, 1-800-730-2727. If you're getting a busy signal, keep trying. And if you're one of the best callers with a question or a comment for Scott Klusendorf, we'll send you his booklet, Pro-Life 101, 1-800-730-2727. Now, if you'd like to receive a free tape of this two-hour broadcast with Scott Klusendorf on defending the pro-life position, contact the local church sponsor that sponsors Issues Etc. in your area. They'll send you a free cassette recording. Get a pen and a piece of paper ready, because you should hear an announcement with a phone number and a mailing address for that sponsor right after the Issues Etc. close theme. We need to be absolutely clear on who is in the womb. Who is there, and why do they have intrinsic value, not a value that we attach to them for some other reason than the fact that they are simply human beings, innocent human beings, that basic morality, basic logic, our basic understanding of right and wrong says they cannot be destroyed needlessly. They cannot be destroyed for our convenience. That we understand them to be created in the image of God, those for whom Christ died. And with that basic understanding, being well prepared to engage in the debate, to see through the false arguments that are often put in our way to cause us to stumble, then we can have that conversation. Then we can enter that debate. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to Pastor Todd Wilkin weekly on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Visit us this week on the World Wide Web. Our website address, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.